I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, my name is Molly, and this is a podcast that my father and I have decided to start. My dad is here.
I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And we are very close, and every Saturday we get together to have lunch. And my dad has a history in crime, not being a criminal, obviously, but a specialist in crime. Dad, can you tell us a bit about your background in crime?
It all started in 1995 when I was asked by the official solicitor to the Supreme Court to write an official biography of the Gloucester serial killer Frederick West. It had been decided that a book should be written for the benefit, at least, of West's children. West, by this time, was dead. He'd killed himself on the 1st of January 1995 at Winston Green Prison in Birmingham. I was given the papers and his police interviews and a great many other things, including, memorably, his clothes. But it started, I'd never written about murder before. I'd written biographies before. I'd written biographies of Cary Grant and Sir James Goldsmith and Terence Rattigan and all manner. And I'd been a journalist for, by that time, 30 years. But crime became a fascination. And I not only write about true crime in books, but I also review crime and thrillers for the Daily Mail and have done for the past nearly 10 years.
But also, to be fair, we've always had a bit of a thing for a detective story, a thriller, and like a natural interest, both of us. We definitely in crime. I love a good detective novel. Can't get enough Poirot.
I think that's true. I mean, when I was doing the West book, the BBC made a documentary about me writing it, and you participated in that.
I know.
You were discussing the what we should call it, what the title should be. And I think pretty much ever since then, and you were then only 11 or 12, since then we have had an abiding interest. And I agree, of course, we'd be fascinated by Poirot. I remember reading Agatha Christie at the age of 8, just as I read Sherlock Holmes and Raffles and all those extraordinary, wonderful crime novels as they were then. And to this day, my week is taken up by reading crime fiction as well as trying to write crime fact.
And you'll still probably spend some evenings watching good eps of Criminal Minds.
Absolutely.
Or CSI.
Criminal Minds.
Classic CSI.
Absolutely.
Season 8 CSI original, my favourite, the one with the model.
The model maker. Wonderful,
best,
wonderful
best
story.
Season. So
and,
good.
And also one of the best climaxes. When it is, of course, revealed that the model maker is dead, but his daughter is taking over. You know, that's effectively...
Plot spoiler, anyone who hasn't seen
you
it.
Haven't seen it. I've ruined it for you. But it is a terrific plot, that, because it quite often crops up in crime fiction. It's often the child. You look at Law and Order, for example. Time after time after time, you're thinking, who could possibly have done it? And then, of course, it's the 12-year-old. It's always, you know, what you didn't know was actually
true.
It's a terrible child.
It's true. We're not going to get into child killers this week, guys, just because that's probably a bit much to start with. But the general idea of the podcast is that each week we're going to pick a killer and my dad is going to tell us all about it. And I'm going to ask questions because I probably don't know as much about it. I might know a bit, but not as much.
For the first one, it was you who said, I'd like to do a poisoner.
Yeah, so basically Dad is indulging my interest in poisoners this week with a poisoner I don't know. So we'll get going. And this is the teacup poisoner. So tell us all about him, her, it.
The teacup poisoner. I think that much of your interest in poisoning is based in Agatha Christie.
100% based in Agatha Christie.
Because Agatha Christie, remember, worked in a pharmacy, in a hospital pharmacy, where she learned a lot about poisons. And many times in the Poirot novels, for example, poisoning is the classic element.
Yeah.
There was a great deal of interest beginning the 20th century in poisoning because it was rather a Victorian crime, often committed by a woman.
As we know, I love Victorians, so
yes.
Another reason.
Often committed by a woman, it's a very intimate crime. It's very personal. It's not random. It's almost always very clearly directed. But the poisoner I've chosen to talk about is a man called Graham Young, who became known as the teacup poisoner. Graham Frederick Young was born in Neasden in North London in 1947. His mother had caught pleurisy during the pregnancy and died shortly after his birth of tuberculosis. He had an elder sister called Winifred and a father called Fred, who was effectively a sort of fitter.
A fitter? What, like a carpet fitter?
Yeah, no, more like a... He worked in factories, in manufacturing.
All right, okay.
Fred was quite young and couldn't cope with the possibility of having to bring up these two children, a baby, Graham Young, and his sister, elder sister, Winifred, who was then about eight. So he farmed them out. Winifred to the grandparents and Fred to an uncle and aunt. Now, it would be fair to say that the death of his mother so early was a catastrophic event in Young's life.
How old was he when his mum died?
Literally months.
Oh, okay. So he didn't remember
his mum. But then when he went back, because Fred remarried, and this is where there's a nice link to you, a woman called Molly.
Oh, classic.
So Fred remarried and brought the children back.
What, both him and his sister?
Yeah, so both Graham and his sister Winifred go back to live with the new family.
Okay.
Now, here comes the rub.
Something bad happens.
What happens is that Young is a very disturbed boy. Very
just
creepy.
By nature.
By nature. Very lonely, very removed, but with a fascination for chemicals. Any kind of chemicals.
Cool.
It would be fair to say that he took against his stepmother in a most dramatic way and began experimenting with various kinds of poisons.
How old was he when this was going on?
Well, he started his interest in poisons at about the age of 10. He started by sniffing nail varnish remover.
Classic.
And then perfume. And as he grew a little older, ether to get some kind of high.
Okay.
And effectively, he was this introverted, strange, rather gaunt-faced little boy, and who had taken against his
new mum,
his stepmother. But he wasn't a fool. The story has it, and I think it might be apocryphal, but I do enjoy it, that because he passed his 11 plus, which was then vital to get into a grammar school, his father gave him a chemistry set as a present.
Good choice, Dad.
Good choice. Because what happened then was that he became utterly fascinated by all kinds of poisons, antimony, thallium, cyanide, arsenic,
and just back then, it was obviously a lot easier to get hold of all this stuff than it would be now, was it?
It was a lot easier, but Young was also very accomplished. At the age of 13, he persuaded two local chemists to give him poison, telling them he was 17 and he was using it for his A-level experiments.
Okay.
Absolute lie. But nevertheless, he added all this together. I think at one point, he had enough poison. And remember, we're talking about a 14-year-old boy. Enough poison to kill 300 people.
What? Where did he keep it? Just in his bedroom?
Yeah, kept in his bedroom. Yes, exactly.
He just kept loads of poison.
Loads of poison. And of course, you know, you don't think, as a father, you don't think your own son's capable of poisoning you, do you? But what happened, and it is very scary, and I think Young is a genuinely terrifying character. Because from a very early age, he demonstrated true psychopathology. He didn't have any conscience at all. And what he wanted to do was to see what the effect of the poisons was on other people. And he started experimenting on his family.
Okay.
And his a friend at school called Christopher Williams.
Friend is a loose term.
Well, they used to eat their packed lunches together.
No, but I
together.
Mean that you would poison your friend, like maybe his concept of friend. And
well, I think everybody was a victim to Young, really.
Anyone he could get is...
Who came across his radar.
Okay.
So at the age of 13, remember he's born in 1947. In 1959, he goes to grammar school, secondary school. by the beginning of 1961, and remember talking about a boy who's 13 going on 14, he is seriously experimenting with all manner of poisons. There is no doubt at all that he starts by poisoning his stepmother using antimony.
What's antimony?
A toxic poison.
A type of poison.
Yes.
Administering that poison.
Usually in the family's tea.
In tea.
Usually, but not always. Sometimes it would be in sandwiches. Mustard pickle on one particular occasion.
Well, that would be a good one for masking the taste of it, I imagine.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because once he tried poisoning his sister with tea, and she only took one gulp of the tea.
It was like this
and said,
tastes
"Oh, this is awful,
horrible."
Nevertheless, she still got hallucinations by the time she got to school later. So you know, it was still serious enough. I mean, he overdid it, but what he did, he started by poisoning his stepmother, and then he went on to poison his father, whom he blamed for his own mother's death.
Yeah.
And so the process began. Poor Molly, young as she then was, paid the ultimate price. She suffered terrible vomiting, excruciating stomach pains, terrible diarrhea, and eventually died. Now, at that point, no member of the family, and certainly not his father nor his sister, suspected for one moment that
he was poisoning
his mother.
But apart from the fact he was the only one who wasn't sick in the whole family.
Oh, but
he
took the precaution of making himself mildly sick.
Oh, just so he's super smart.
Super smart. The family put Molly's death down to an accident she'd had. She'd been knocked down earlier, about a year before, and it had had an effect on her. And they thought it was somehow a reflection of what had happened in this accident. She was cremated. That's what you did. Nobody suspected.
So nobody was going to go and do an autopsy and find out what was going on in there.
And it was almost, and in fact, at one point when Young finally confessed, he called it the perfect murder because there was no evidence whatever. But Young's trouble was that he couldn't stop. It was, he once said himself, it's like I was addicted to drugs, except I wasn't taking the drugs. He was addicted to giving other people
the
drugs.
Yeah, and so I think this is kind of similar to that thing that we've talked about the we've called what you've described as predators of death before. So I've heard another podcast talking about an American nurse who was very keen on taking people to the brink of death and bringing them back and using drugs.
It's a famous syndrome.
So this kind of syndrome is like the one you get often in the nurses and doctors realm where somebody is, playing God, basically.
Harold Shipman, Beverly Allitt, two British cases.
Yeah.
I think Ian Brady, who went at one stage befriended Young in prison, the Moore's murderer, said that power and death were Young's only aphrodisiacs. He was genuinely asexual. He wasn't interested in that.
Yeah.
He was interested in control.
Yeah.
And he was interested in killing people. And he took elaborate and careful notes of exactly what doses he was going to give his victims, what he was going to try out, and then whether or not he would give them more doses in the hope that they die. In other words, he wanted the power of life and death. It was a godlike power.
Yeah, okay. But by this stage, when his stepmother dies, he's still, I'm guessing, pretty young then.
He's 14.
14. He was 14. 14. He started killing people when he was 14.
And what's eerie about it, she died on Easter Sunday, 1962. He was 14. Gradually, one or two members of the family, the extended family, began having some suspicions, especially as his father had suddenly developed terrible symptoms similar to the ones that his wife, his now widow, had developed.
Yeah.
And Winifred had started developing these symptoms. And another member of the family became rather suspicious of that. And they set up Fred to discuss with a person he thought was a careers advisor. Actually, it was a psychiatrist.
Well, oh, you mean Graham, to get Graham to talk to.
Yes, to get Graham to talk to a psychiatrist.
Someone he made, they made him think it was a careers advisor, but actually wasn't. It was a psychiatrist. Yeah.
Well, the said psychiatrist immediately recommended calling the police. And so on the 23rd of May, 1962, Young was arrested. And he confessed to the attempted murder of his father, his sister, and his school friend, Christopher Williams.
Age 14?
Yep.
And what did they do?
Well, I'm afraid he was detained under the 1959 Mental Health Act. And it was decided that he had to go to Broadmoor Special Hospital, one of, at that point, only three special hospitals for the criminally insane. And this was the youngest person to be admitted to Broadmoor since 1885. He was that rare.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that does, yeah.
Now, Young was nobody's fool. And became, in a way, going to Broadmoor was a wonderful help because he had plenty of time to study medical texts, conduct chemical experiments of his own. And pretty soon after he arrived there, a fellow inmate called Berridge, John Berridge, died of poisoning. And the staff said, well, you know, it couldn't have been a fellow inmate because no one's got access to poison. Sometime later, Young said, ah, but what you don't know is you can get cyanide from the leaves of laurel bushes, and there are an awful lot of laurel bushes in the Broadmoor estate.
Okay, so he was just, wherever he could find it, he would make basically.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about a man who was truly obsessed, but he was also clever enough to convince Broadmoor that he had reformed.
They let him out.
Originally, he'd been told he would have to serve at least 15 years. After 9, he had so persuaded the chief psychiatrist at Broadmoor that he was a reformed individual that he got him to write to the Home Secretary of the day, because his detention originally had said he could not be released until it was approved by the Home Secretary of the day. The psychiatrist, after about 8 years in Broadmoor, writes, a man infamous now in the history of poisoners, wrote to the Home Secretary saying that Young was no longer, and I quote, obsessed with poisons, violence and mischief.
Which was clearly not the case.
But it was certainly what the psychiatrist believed and wrote to the Home Secretary. And so the Home Secretary, not surprisingly,
said he can go home.
Said, well, really, and even more chilling, I love this detail. Young, smart as a tack, writes to his sister Winifred and says, your friendly neighbourhood Frankenstein will soon be released.
Oh, that is creepy.
And Winifred, of course,
he's just an experimenter, basically. He just, like, uses humans to...
But I think that's just such a wonderful thought, isn't it? Your friendly neighbourhood Frankenstein.
What did Winifred say?
Oh, she was very pleased he was coming home. He was that kind of man. He had this extraordinary ability, as many serial killers do, of this neuro-linguistic skill of being able to say, pretend to be harmless. Oh, I'm perfectly harmless. While at the same time concealing a desperate desire to control and to kill. So Winifred takes him to live with her and her new husband, Dennis.
Oh, no.
In their home in Hemel-Sempstead, no?
Winifred, he doesn't. Not a good plan, he surely. Does.
No, it gets better. He doesn't try to poison Winifred again. I think perhaps at least in the meantime, he's got other fish to fry.
Mm.
He finally gets a job in a factory, a laboratory, manufacturing infrared lenses for armaments. Oh, one of the benefits of this particular factory
is he's surrounded by
thallium, toxic poison, and others. The factory is in Bovingdon, not very far from Hemel Hempstead. And soon after he gets there, a number of his colleagues start falling ill.
You surprised me.
Mm. But of course, this case is Stockman, he's a bit of a nerd. He certainly doesn't look violent. He's a bit restrained. He's a bit creepy.
What do you think he's doing? Do you think he was, like, going into people's packed lunches while they weren't looking?
Oh, no. He was serving them tea.
He was serving them tea. Okay, so the teacup poisoner thing is just basically because he was like the guy in the office we all love, which is like, would you like a cup of tea? Yes, please.
Yes.
Thanks so much.
That's great. And in fact, at one point, they thought, well, something must be up with the tea. So they started changing the cups round. But by that time, it was same difference. So first of all, his third victim, if you count his stepmother as his first, if you count his fellow prisoner,
oh yes, of course,
Broadmoor as his second, his third victim was a sad but rather nice man, a foreman at the lab, called Bob Eagle, who was 59 when he died on the 7th of July 1971, having been poisoned. But of course, nobody thought he'd been poisoned.
Everyone just thought he'd died of natural causes,
poor,
or
sausage, you know,
poor Bob.
I mean, he had. A number of his colleagues in the factory had nausea and vomiting, and one or two had even had to be hospitalised. But they put it down to what they called the Bovingdon bug, because at the same time, by sheer coincidence, although maybe Young wanted to use it to his advantage, a lot of children had caught something. And they called it the Bovingdon bug.
So a bit
bug.
Like norovirus going around now, and everyone drops
says,
their fries or whatever.
Yeah,
it's a bug in the office or in the laboratory or whatever.
It's been estimated that in this period of time, we're talking about 1971, Young probably poisoned 70 people.
Poisoned and killed, or poisoned
no,
and...
poisoned.
In, poisoned, okay.
Poisoned.
Right.
He only killed one more person.
Uh-huh.
But by the same process of giving them increasing doses, often of what the heavy metal toxic called thallium.
Okay.
And the second man was a man called Fred Biggs, who was 60, another of his workmates, taken seriously ill, and he died in November 1971. Now, gradually, the concept of the Bovingdon bug was
knocking
off.
Can't last this long and solely be related to tea.
Especially as Young was nothing if not a bit of a swank. He liked nothing more than bragging about how much he knew about toxins. And oh, yes. And so when the police, you know, the doctor who had been involved in examining poor old Fred, he said to him, Young said to him, oh, have you considered thallium poisoning?
So he gave himself, well, not gave himself up, but gave them the...
Well, he gave them what you might describe as a clue.
Yeah.
So on the 21st of November, not long after Fred, the second victim at Bovingdon, dies, Young is arrested on a visit to his father and aunt in Sheerness in Kent. The police arrive at about 11:30 in the evening.
Uh-huh.
And his father opens the door and knows immediately why they're there.
Yeah, of course.
He knows that Fred...
Graham
is not the man that he hoped he would be.
Yeah.
And in fact, is an absolute monster.
Yeah.
And in fact, that night, after the police had taken Graham away, his father collected all the records of Graham's childhood, including his birth certificate, and tore them all up, destroyed them all.
Did they find, like, all of those documents where he'd written all down who was, dosing
well,
who and how much and everything?
When he was arrested, he was found with thallium on his person. But he was also, his house, he rented a room, wasn't staying with his sister at that time. And more poison was found there, along with a series of drawings depicting death and a diary, which effectively said, oh, Mr. X got Y amount, Mr. Z got X amount. A careful notation of who'd been given what. It should also be said that among Young's other obsessions was Joseph Mengele, the Nazi doctor who killed so many. And
he always used to joke you had glasses a bit like
that's
him.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he wore swastika badges to school. and
Graham wore swastika badges to school.
Yes, wore swastika badges to school. And when he was in Broadmoor, he made wooden swastikas. And at one point, he grew a Hitler moustache.
Graham was just all types of evil, wasn't he? He just really nailed it.
But I don't think nowadays, if you said the word Graham Young to most people, they go, never heard of him.
Yeah, I know, but I think some of those kind of old, like, you know, I hope that we'll be able to cover quite a few of those, because I'm a big fan of an old school serial killer. But, you know, we move on to the next thing. The next face of evil turns up, and that's, you know.
Well, in the end, although at the first moment of arrest, Young confesses, when he gets to trial, which took place in St Albans Crown Court in June 1972, he pleads not guilty. He says he had nothing to do with it, and the diary, which noted down who was getting what, and was a fantasy he was going to use for a novel. And it was all entirely harmless.
Yeah, but he just thought that up while he was in custody.
Well, the trial only lasted 10 days, and he was indeed convicted of 4 murders, although they didn't have any concrete proof of the first two.
Yeah.
And was dubbed, and that was the point at which he was dubbed, the teacup poisoner. My old friend and colleague Tony Holden wrote a book about him not long after the trial, which was called The St Albans Poisoner, but that never stuck. He's in everybody's mind.
Teacup poisoner. And so did he go back to Broadmoor or did he go somewhere else?
No, he didn't go straight back to Broadmoor because by this time I think people thought, well, he may be pretending to be mad, but he clearly isn't mad.
He's not insane. This guy's a calculated killer.
And so he went to jail. But one of the first people he encountered when he got to jail was Moore's murderer Ian Brady, at that point wasn't in a special hospital. And at that point wasn't trying to kill himself by going on hunger strike. And in fact, Brady put Young in his book, 2002 book, The Gates of Janus, in which he said it was impossible not to feel empathy with Graham Young. And in fact, a number of people who were in prison with him wrote later about what an engaging character he was.
Oh, well, I'm sure he was. Not uncommon.
No, on the contrary. There has been and remains a great deal of speculation. He died in 1990 at the age of just 42, just before his 43rd birthday. There's been considerable speculation that he poisoned himself by using elements from the prison bars. It wouldn't be beyond him. It has never been proven. The official cause of death was a heart attack. Although whether that had been brought on by persistent experiment with poisonous substances. If you ask what's going on here and why did Young do it, a couple of quotes that he himself said I find very chilling. At one point he said, "What I feel is an emptiness of the soul." And at another, he said, "There's a terrible coldness inside me." And I think at some point, some people have suggested he suffered from autism. He may have had a schizophrenic disorder. He certainly was psychopathic. But there was possibly more even to it than that. That godlike concept that we're talking about is... Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, it's just, I think that there's that thing about the control thing, isn't it? And also, like, oftentimes with serial killers, you know, you get that kind of release or satisfaction specifically from that action, and therefore that's the thing that makes you feel better, so you want to keep doing it all the time. So that's not...
Or you become utterly fixated on it.
Yeah, because you want to, I'm sure that the fixation comes from the feeling of it.
Yes.
And probably the good thing about poisoning, she says, not that I have any idea, obviously, but it would be like when you murder someone, if you stab someone or something or strangle them, whatever, that kind of release is very short-lived and then it's done and then you want to find it again. But if you're poisoning people to like different levels of distress, you can kind of balance that out all the time and be
But he did say, you know, I could decide who lived and who died. And I think that was obviously an important element to him. The ultimate price they would pay would be with their lives.
Yeah.
And ironically, not long after his death, um, well, 15 years later, a 16-year-old Japanese girl poisoned her mother with thallium and saying that she'd been fixated on Young and that Young was a figure not
there's
to be.
There's got to be some, there's still got to be some poisoners out there, Dad. I'm sure they're not all just doctors and nurses.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, the most famous poison of all is clearly Dr. Crippen.
My God, I don't even know about Dr. Crippen.
Well, Dr. Crippen was the first man to be arrested on by the use of radio when he ran off to New York.
Well, we need to do Dr. Crippen another day.
Another day for Dr. Crippen.
Another day for
there
Dr.
was also
Crippen.
Quite a famous Victorian doctor, I think called Packerell.
I know, but I'm saying poisoners who are non-doctors. That's why I like Graham.
Yes.
Because he's a non-doctor.
He was certainly, no, he wasn't masquerading.
Yeah.
As an angel of death.
No, exactly.
As Shipman was doing,
yeah,
for
yeah,
example.
exactly. And not hiding behind.
He wasn't hiding behind, I'm doing the best for you. No, Young was doing it entirely because he liked doing it.
Yeah.
And because it was, in his mind anyway, I suppose, his hobby as well as his fixation. It was his entire life.
Yeah.
He was a very evil man. Afterwards, there were lots of accounts of records that he kept of wishing people dead and drawings of people with, and at one point I think he carried round a small doll with pins stuck in
it. Oh, what are they called? Voodoo dolls.
Voodoo doll.
Yeah.
Which he said was his stepmother. This is when he was a young man. He was clearly deeply disturbed and yet could persuade Broadmoor that he could be let out. The Home Secretary agreed he should be let out. Funnily enough, after his conviction, the then Home Secretary, Reginald Maudling, immediately ordered two full-scale inquiries into the way in which we allowed dangerous chemicals, notably poison, to be sold over the counter.
Oh, well, there you go.
There was a debate in the House.
Something good came out of it.
If there was anything, that was the good
they
part.
They need to do that now with acid so people can stop throwing it in
they
people's
did.
Faces.
Although at one point, just for the contemporary relevance, Young carried acid round. Especially when he was at school. Ugh. He burnt one of his school blazers with acid. It's a rather awful thought.
Well, I'm glad he's not still out there.
No, he's not.
Well, there you go.
He's had he lived, he would be 70.
Yeah, I was going to say he's around your age, isn't he?
He's only 2 years younger than me. And I find that slightly terrifying.
Pretty creepy.
But I do think that he's what you might describe as a sort of a kind of forgotten serial killer in Britain.
Yeah, well, here we are bringing him back. Do you think we've covered him?
I hope so. What I hope is that none of these podcasts give people nightmares or keep them awake. But what I would say, and I've said this before, I remember when I did the West book, I gave it to an Express reporter who'd been much involved in the case, covered the case, Rosemary West's trial, as I did. And I said to her, you know, just don't read this book at night. And she said, don't be silly. I know the whole case backwards. You know, I was at the trial.
No.
And I think it was 36 hours later, she rang me and she said, I couldn't read this at night.
Yeah.
It's simply too terrifying.
I mean, it's happened to me. My new obsession with the true crime podcast has led to me having terrible nightmares and I have to not listen to them at night.
Yes.
Because, I mean, we've started with a relatively gentle one, but it's not sadly always going to stay this way.
No.
But we promise you, listeners, that we are going to kind of like raise the tone always at the end. So
yeah, and talk about what we're going to do.
Have a little bit of a chat. We'll just let you know what we're getting up to the rest of the week and, you know, until we do our next record. So I'm going to a wedding in Devon this weekend.
Yes,
my friend Alistair's getting married.
Wonderful. But you're not going, you're just going on your own.
Going on my own, Dad. Feeling a bit anxious about it. I'm mainly anxious about the part in between the ceremony and the dinner when you mill about. You know that milling about when they hand out champagne and you mill. The milling section I'm really worried about. Because when I'm actually sat at the table, I'll be fine.
Oh, no.
I can do that part.
I've always thought that there is only one trick to that. And that is to stand absolutely still.
Don't move.
Don't move. Let the party come to you.
Yeah, the party come to you. I used to do that at parties. I always used to pick a spot and just stay there and wait for it to rotate around me. So by far the easiest.
That's
and
by
most
far the
comfortable.
Best way. What am I doing? It's been a busy week. Yesterday I did a tour at the Garrick Club for some nice people from the Players Club in New York. I've got all manner of responsibilities. I've just filed some crime reviews, thriller reviews this morning.
You've never been so busy, Dad.
I've never been as busy as I am. And one reason, extraordinarily, is people's fascination with
true crime.
I cannot completely understand it, but there it is. And people stop me in the street and say, oh, I saw you on that documentary about some terrible...
Britain's Most Evil Killers.
Yes, or the world's most evil killers, or whatever it happened. And I couldn't do... For example, I was away last week and I got rung up by ITN, who were doing something about Becky Watts, and then they wanted to do Steve Wright, the Suffolk Strangler. I've never been in as much demand.
I know, people, you are in high demand.
People want to know why. They want to know why. Why did he do that? Why did she do that?
And also, we've talked about that thing before, is that, like, it's just the idea that they're next to you and near you and could be around you and, you know.
There's nothing more frightening than the fact...
There's something really frightening about that.
Yes. Well, it's the frightening of normalcy, isn't it? It's everything seems so normal. I mean, Young didn't look odd. I mean, didn't have antlers or a tail or a black cloak
You mean that they're not all? Yeah, they're among us.
Yes,
that's the thing.
I mean, Steve Wright. Just thinking of him, the Suffolk Strangler. I mean, was a steward on P&O ferries. I mean, you know, it's perfectly ordinary, in a way, and yet killed five prostitutes in Ipswich. It's that fact that it could be you, or you could have met him.
Yeah,
that's what I think sends a shiver down people's
it's
spine.
Really creepy. It's true. Okay, well, next week we're going to do the Wedding Massacre,
which I'm afraid might be a little less
bit grim,
a little less cheery than Graham Young.
Yeah. Well, we're onwards and upwards. Great. Thanks so much, and we'll be back in a couple of weeks.
Thank you so much, darling.